what we saw in Haiti with this earthquake was clearly a terrible natural disaster. But the human toll, or the political and social elements, I think have been very much underplayed. So for instance, in 1989 in San Francisco, there was a 6.9 earthquake. 69 people died. In Port-au-Prince, with this 7.0 earthquake, 200,000 plus people died. So there's a reason for that discrepancy, or that the amount of suffering. And I think the picture that BC painted of the history of Western imperialism in Haiti and how that has weakened Haitian institutions is a major explanation for why Haiti's institutions weren't able to better prevent the destruction from the earthquake, or able to respond to the disaster. There's a couple of points I wanted, specific elements that explain why this earthquake was as damaging as much human suffering was caused, and they're tied into the fact that Port-au-Prince is a city of 2 to 3 million people, when in fact it was built, I'm talking about before the earthquake, when in fact it was built for 200, 300, 400,000 people. And over the past few decades, there's been a massive influx of people from the countryside into Port-au-Prince. And that is directly tied to policy that's been pursued by the International Monetary Fund, by the U.S. government, with Canadian aid, Canada playing a small part in that process. So over the past 25 years, Haiti has gone from producing basically all of its rice to importing basically all of its rice. And that's directly tied to push by the International Monetary Fund, U.S., Canadian governments to reduce the tariffs on rice. And that, the effect of that has been to devastate the peasantry. People are no longer able to make a living at growing rice, and they've been driven out of the countryside and into the city, and hence we're living in Port-au-Prince in very dangerous circumstances. And not that they didn't know that, right? People living in Port-au-Prince along the ravine, up the hill, they knew that their housing was weak, that was potentially vulnerable, but they just had no other option. It was a question of impoverishment, a question of not having the economic means to make a different choice. And of course, in the earthquake, that housing largely collapsed, and people died. Another reason for why there's been a real push, a real move from the countryside, another element, direct policy choice pushed by the U.S. and Canadian governments that has led to this exodus of the countryside, is in 1983, Washington pushed this program of getting rid of all of the Creole pigs in the country. So all of the pigs that had grown accustomed to the conditions of the Haitian countryside, very hardy, didn't need much water, didn't need much food, were able to sort of eat what was left over. And this was because the pigs, according to the U.S. government, were diseased, and Washington was nervous that this would lead to an infection of U.S. Pig stock. American government, and this was Canadian aid, supported this process, said that they would replace all these pigs with pigs from Iowa. Well, by chance, these pigs in Iowa necessitated mounts of food and water that were much more than the peasants themselves were consuming, hence were obviously not capable of living in the environment in the Haitian countryside, and they were called the princes à quatre pattes, so like the princes on four legs. So they needed so much, need to be looked after so much that it wasn't viable for. And the effect of this shouldn't be understated, because pigs for the peasantry were a sort of bank, a piggy bank, if you like, where if there was a baptism, if there was a child that needed to go to school, if there was a funeral, a pig would often be sold to get the money for that. So the effect of destroying the Haitian Creole pigs actually led, there's some studies that show that there was a direct decrease in enrollment in school kids, peasants, kids enrolled in school with this destruction of the Creole pig. So I think these are some specific policies that exacerbated the toll because of the undermining of the agricultural sector that exacerbated the toll of this earthquake. We should note that this undermining of the Haitian agricultural sector fits into a larger perspective that Western free market economists, how they view Haiti, and how Haiti's comparative advantage to world capitalism or to free market economists is as a hub of cheap labor to produce t-shirts, other apparel, baseballs, or other things like that. Montreal-based Gildan Activewear, the world's biggest blank t-shirt maker, has been said to be the second biggest employer in Haiti, both directly and indirectly after the Haitian state. So Canadian companies that are part of this process. So, of course, if you want to have sweatshops and have people who will work at $2 or $3 a day, the Haitian minimum wage recently increased, was just increased to $3 a day. That's with the recent increase. If you want to have people who will work for these abysmal wages, well, you need to have lots of desperate people. Hence, the people moving in from the countryside with very few options is sort of a reserve labor of cheap labor for foreign and domestic companies to produce t-shirts and other apparel products. So this undermining the agricultural sector fits in with how international capital sees Haiti as a hub of cheap labor. The reaction to this earthquake, Canada, U.S., French reaction, and others' reaction to the earthquake, is a continuation of the policy of elite, supporting the Haitian elite, supporting foreign interests over the interests of the poor majority. So the initial search and rescue that went into Haiti, international search and rescue. Of course, Haitians themselves in their neighborhoods were doing what they could to get save neighbors or save family members or whatnot. But the initial international search and rescue, where did it focus on? It focused on places like the UN compound, the Hotel Montana, places where foreigners and wealthy Haitians would go. And there were a number of reports we received in the first few days after the search and rescue, that after the earthquake, of search and rescue teams who simply refused to enter the slum neighborhoods because they were seen as dangerous. The effort was focused on where internationals were. Second part is the militarization of this aid and relief effort. Haiti today has more troops per square kilometer, more foreign troops per square kilometer than Iraq or Afghanistan. There's been a serious militarization, and it's not just sort of abstractly a problematic thing, but there's been a deprioritization of relief efforts or of aid efforts to bring in troops, especially in the first few days. So Canada's heavy urban research rescue teams, based in Toronto, Calgary, and numerous other cities in this country, were not sent to Haiti. They're designed to search and rescue. That's their point. They weren't sent to Haiti. They were ready to go, weren't sent to Haiti, because the Canadian government, according to the Foreign Affairs Minister Lawrence Cannon, prioritized sending Canadian troops. 2,000 Canadian troops that were sent, 12 to 20,000 American troops, and thousands more UN forces. Likewise, the American government, which took control of the Toussaint Louverture airport the day after the earthquake, and only got Haitian government okay 2 days later, the American government blocked at least five flights from Médecins Sans Frontières, full of medical supplies, in the first few days after the earthquake. So there was this this prioritization on the military, deprioritization on the humanitarian, and the rationale for this was really this process of demonizing the Haitian majority, right? This whole undercurrent of racism, this violence, this looting that we would hear about, this real demonization of the poor black majority in Haiti. So for instance, I was looking for information on Cité Soleil in the first days after the earthquake. Cité Soleil is anywhere between 200,000 and 500,000 people, somewhere between 10 and 25% of Port-au-Prince's population. I did not find any information in the mainstream media about Cité Soleil in the first 4 or 5 days after the earthquake until the storyline started coming out that the gangs were returning to Cité Soleil. And then the gangs, what Cité Soleil, which was a terribly impoverished place before the earthquake, had just been hit by a massive earthquake. But according to our media, the main problem for people living in Cité Soleil was the gangs, which is absurdity, water, food, and our media sort of pushing this line of the gangs in Cité Soleil. But what was that designed to do? That was designed to justify the militarization of the aid process, the militarization of the country. And I think the militarization of the aid country has two basic logics. One is this sort of racist logic of seeing Haitians as dangerous, as enemy combatants, and just the logic of the sort of association between black people and violence. That's the one hand. The other logic is, as a geostrategic, the U.S. military, Canadian military, like the idea of having a deeper and deeper military presence all throughout, well, the world, Latin America and the world, I think. Unfortunately, what we've seen since this earthquake is not some enlightened humanism or a change in Canadian U.S. policy towards Haiti, saying, okay, what we've done in the past was wrong and now we're going to work in a more humane way, but rather a continuation of the same logic of demonization of the poor majority, militarization in contexts that simply do not deserve that. Another part I want to just point out about the last few weeks is immediately many forces within the establishment in this country, in the U.S., began talking about how this disaster could be used for reforming Haiti's economy, building Haiti in a way that further served their interests. So the Heritage Foundation in the U.S., 24 hours after earthquake, already had a report out saying that basically this would be an opportunity to reform Haiti's economy to better serve outside interests. And so you have a sort of the disaster capitalism taking place, where this catastrophe is an opportunity to push economic reforms that would otherwise be more difficult or would otherwise be resisted in a more serious way by the Haitian population. And that's the pages of the Globe and Mail. Right, the Globe and Mail has just simply jumped on board this, the official editorial, 2 days after the earthquake, right away saying this kind of stuff. So we have to be very vigilant about this, and that vigilant that the aid and reconstruction in Haiti goes to serving Haitian interests, majority impoverished interests, and not Canadian and American corporations. A couple points about this sort of film and the 2004 coup, the fallout of that I think are for people interested in foreign policy and Canadian foreign policy are somewhat relevant. Canada helped plan the coup 13 months beforehand. There was a meeting in just outside Ottawa on Meech Lake, which was later dubbed the Ottawa Initiative on Haiti, where the Canadian government invited the minister from the French government, invited high-level officials from the Bush administration, officials from the Organization of American States, where they decided that Aristide must go, that Haiti should be put under UN trusteeship, and that the Haitian army should be recreated. That was all reported on L'Actualité magazine, which is Quebec's equivalent to Maclean's. That was reported on a year before that stuff happened. So it was reported on in L'Actualité, and 13 months later, Aristide was gone. 13 months after this meeting, Aristide was gone. Haiti's been basically under UN trusteeship for the last six years, UN control, and there's been a sort of recreation of the Haitian army that Canada's been part of overseeing through the Haitian National Police. Canada also cut off aid to Haiti's elected government, What aid money Canada was putting into Haiti between 2001 and 2003 was almost entirely going to non-governmental organizations, by chance, many of which participated in the destabilization campaign against the Aristide government. So all the groups Canada was funding happened to be anti-Aristide groups. So Canada played a significant role in the destabilization and overthrow of the Aristide government. It wasn't just Aristide who was overthrown, but thousands of elected officials. Additionally, there were Canadian troops at the airport, Toussaint-Louverture airport, that Aristide says he was kidnapped from by U.S. Marines on February 29th, 2004, and then dumped in the Central African Republic. So there were Canadian troops that had actually invaded the country. And then there were about 500 Canadian troops that occupied Haiti from late February 2004 until August 2004. So, but Canada played a significant role in the destabilization and overthrow of the Aristide government, but played an even more important role in the post-coup backing of the Gérard Latortue dictatorship. Gérard Latortue was taken from southern Florida, had not been in Haiti for 15 years, and was taken and put as prime minister of the country by Washington. And Canada played a very important role in supporting the Latortue dictatorship. So there'd never been a Canadian prime minister that had gone to Haiti. So while there were Haiti elected governments in Haiti, Canadian prime minister had never gone down to, you know, sort of bestow advanced relations, whatnot. But with Latortue in power, Paul Martin made the first ever trip by Canadian prime minister to diplomatically support this dictatorship, which was not being recognized by the Caribbean community, which should be the body in the region that would have the most knowledge of the situation and closest to the situation. The Caribbean community refused to recognize the post-coup dictatorship. You had Canada in charge of the policing elements of the UN mission. There were about 8,000 UN troops and 2,000 UN police officers. There's usually a Canadian in charge of the police mission, about 100 Canadian police officers there. And they were overseeing training the Haitian National Police. Canada put tens and tens of millions of dollars into the Haitian National Police, while that same Haitian National Police, as you might see some in the movie, would go into Bel Air, go into Cité Soleil, and massacre people. Places bastions of support for Aristide, while the Haitian National Police repeatedly fired on peaceful demonstrations demanding the return of Haiti's elected president. From late 2004 to early 2005, there's probably half a dozen examples of the Haitian National Police firing on peaceful demonstrations reported on by Reuters, Associated Press, Agence France-Presse. I'm not talking about if you read Haitian media, there's even more examples, but even among mainstream North American, European media outlets, these were being reported on. Never once did a Canadian official say, this is not right, while we were funding, training these forces. Pretty much all arms of the Canadian government, the Canadian state, were involved in supporting this dictatorship that was in Haiti for about 27 months from March 2004 until May of 2006. The military, as I mentioned, 500 Canadian troops, police, diplomatic support, aid. So while money was mostly cut off to the Aristide government, all of a sudden you have a dictatorship, Canadian aid started flowing in Haiti, all the way into so-called non-governmental organizations. Canadian NGOs played an important role in destabilizing the Aristide government and really justifying the post-coup repression. So a series of Canadian NGOs, Montreal, called the Concertation pour Haïti, which is a body of about a dozen different NGOs in Quebec, actually called for Aristide's overthrow on February 16th, 2004. They did so at the same time that CIA thugs were coming in from the Dominican Republic and attacking different cities in the country with that same demand. These NGOs all happened to be funded by the Canadian government for work in Haiti, sometimes significantly. For people who are familiar with the details of what's going on in Haiti, and then we try to explain to people how the positions so-called progressive NGOs were taking on Haiti, how dubious these positions were, sometimes very difficult to explain that to people because you needed to know a certain level of detail. So for instance, the Montreal NGO called Alternatives, about 8 or 9 months after the coup, had an article where they called Samba Boukman and Ronald Saint-Jean, two Haitian activists, Ronald Saint-Jean, who I've met and I've read two of his books, a preeminent human rights activist in the country. They called these two people criminals. If you don't know who Samba Boukman and Ronald Saint-Jean are, it's very difficult to say how disgusting this is and how this is contributing to the demonization of these people, which would justify the killing, the repression of these people. And Ronald Saint-Jean's group was actually attacked a few months after the coup, and their offices were attacked. So anyways, we would tell people this was happening, but it was kind of a he said, she said. I'd say Alternatives, this preeminent Montreal NGO, was saying this, but people would say, well, who's Ronald Saint-Jean? Who's Samba Boukman? I don't really trust you. But Alternatives, which is Quebec's major supporter of the World Social Forum, they had a report that came out in 2008, which I was actually kind of happy about, because you can see their colonial language openly displayed. You don't need to know details of Haitian politics to understand it. So part of the report reads, quote, this is called Haiti, Voices of the Actors. It reads, quote, in a country like Haiti, in which democratic culture has never taken hold, the concept of the common good and the meaning of elections and representation are limited to the educated elites, and in particular to those who have received citizen education within the social movements. That's another way of saying Haitians are too stupid to know what's good for them unless they've been trained by a foreign NGO. To see that really clear colonial language, and this is a group, Alternatives, this is a group that tried to associate themselves for a long time, associate themselves with the likes of Noam Chomsky and Naomi Klein. It was startling to see the disconnect between the way NGOs are represented in Canadian society and the way they're represented in Haiti, or often. The day after the earthquake on CNN and Radio-Canada, a number of commentators mentioned that one of the upsides to the earthquake, or they didn't really say exactly the upside of the earthquake, but the silver lining in this horrible catastrophe was the fact there were lots of NGOs operating in Haiti. So it's like this was this one upside. And that, you know, we could get aid there quickly and whatnot. Well, the reality is it has been shown now 3 weeks after, the NGOs are completely incapable of any serious mass-scale mobilization of the population, and they've been a catastrophe when it comes to everything from search and rescue and getting water and food to the population. I did it in early 2008. There were a number of storms, tropical storms, hurricanes in Haiti, and I did a sort of an analysis of the Quebec media's response to that and the Haitian media. So at that time, I think it's more or less equivalent today with the earthquake. The Quebec media was all positive about these NGOs as, again, this sort of silver lining, how the NGOs can provide relief, and NGOs are really seen as the way forward, as the saviors. Well, in the Haitian political context, across the political spectrum, there was criticism of NGOs. So in the far left, you had Haiti Progrès, a newspaper that called the NGOs in Haiti, quote, a mafia, to the new prime minister at that point, who was actually from an NGO background. Immediately when she got office, she criticized the NGO sectors, to the far right of Yuri Latortue, who's the nephew of the dictator Gérard Latortue, who's a senator, who was very critical of the NGOs. So in the Haitian political milieu, across the board, there's criticism of NGOs, but in Canada, it's NGOs are the saviors, and in fact, the NGOs in Haiti have been used by the Canadian government very consciously, and the U.S. and other governments, to undermine the Haitian government's capacity to provide services, to be involved in the country's affairs. So almost all of social services in Haiti are provided by charities, usually foreign-funded NGOs. So more than 80% of schools, hospitals, etc., NGOs are. And Haiti is the place in the world where NGOs have the most power, probably of anywhere in the world. Some people say and the most NGOs per capita of anywhere in the world. And they've shown to be a catastrophe. And too often, progressive-minded people in this country who believe that there should be a public education system, should believe there should be a public health care, are willing to support groups like Oxfam Quebec or Development and Peace, Doctors Without Borders even, that undermine those same services being run in a logical public manner in Haiti. There's an issue, and one of the things I learned about by participating in the Haiti Solidarity Movement was just the extent to which NGOs can become simply an arm of Canadian imperialism. A second point that's interesting for those that follow Canadian foreign policy is the question of the responsibility to protect doctrine. The responsibility to protect doctrine is something pushed by people like Michael Ignatieff, former Foreign Affairs Minister Lloyd Axworthy. And it basically says that when there's a country that's a failed state or there's massive human rights violations in a country, it's the responsibility of the international community to intervene in the country's affairs. It's this responsibility to protect doctrine that the Canadian government used to justify cutting off aid to Haiti's elected government, Aristide government, used to justify militarily intervening into the country. And for me, the responsibility to protect is really just a high-minded sounding moral justification for imperialism. And the Canadian government is trying to have the United Nations actually incorporate the responsibility to protect into international law. And I don't think right now, with the Stephen Harper government, we don't have to be too concerned about the responsibility to protect doctrine being used to justify an act of aggression by the Canadian U.S. government. The Harper government's just like, let's just do it. We don't need to justify it with nice-sounding moral kind of justifications. But people like Michael Ignatieff and the Liberal Party, they want to do the same, more or less the same thing, but they want to put a bit of PR spin on it that makes it sound like it's a great noble cause. So with Ignatieff possibly becoming the next prime minister, it's important to be conscious of it. And the final thing is the question of the UN peacekeeping being a tool of imperialism, but a tool of class war. And in Haiti, the UN police force has been very clearly, a UN peacekeeping force has been very clearly a tool of class war. The most startling examples are on July 6th, 2005, when they went into Cité Soleil, killed at least 23 civilians, including women and children, one-year-old, four-year-old, many others, all under the guise of getting these gangs that were supposed to be associated with Aristide, but really what the aim was terrorizing a whole community that was overwhelmingly supportive of the elected government. Did very similar things in places like Bel Air, another major slum neighborhood. December 22nd, UN troops went into Cité Soleil again, at least a dozen civilians killed. And there was example after example of one, two, three people being killed by UN troops. Additionally, when there was the food riots, the protests against the rising price of food in April of 2008, and it was UN troops that stepped in to quell those demonstrations, killing a handful of protesters. So you really see the role the UN plays in maintaining the inequity of the country, the inequality, the continuation of this situation where there's a small elite in Haiti that own the vast majority of the property. And in reality, we shouldn't be surprised that UN troops are waging class war in Haiti. The reality is in 1960, between 1960 and 1963, a Canadian-backed UN mission in the Congo helped undermine, destabilize, and lead to the assassination of Patrice Lumumba, who was one of Africa's preeminent independence leaders. We know that Canada-backed UN mission in Egypt in 1956 was not designed to protect Egyptian civilians or to defend Egyptian sovereignty, but was designed to support Washington's geopolitical interests in the Middle East. Likewise, what some say is maybe actually the first UN military mission which was the Korean War of 1950 to 1953, 4 million people were killed in that brutal campaign. So we shouldn't actually be surprised that UN troops would be used to serve Western imperial and class interests, but too often the political culture in this country portrays peacekeeping as some sort of benevolent act that is disassociated from the political objectives, the political imperatives of Canadian foreign policy. Canadian foreign policy, which is what I delve into in the Black Book of Canadian Foreign Policy, has been structured to defend or to support empire, historically British, today American, and to support Canadian corporate interests abroad. Certainly racism does affect Canadian foreign policy, and I think the case of Haiti is an example where racism is a significant dose of racism in the policy. But primarily it's about defending empire and defending Canadian corporate interests abroad. The extent to which that is minimized is only through popular participation in defining Canadian foreign policy, in democratizing Canadian foreign policy, and getting increasing numbers of Canadians mobilized on the issue everywhere from writing petitions to occupying offices. That's the instances where Canada has moved away, whether it be in the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa, the Iraq War, where Canada didn't officially join the coalition willing. The only reason that happened was because there was mass participation of Canadians in solidarity movements. When it comes to Haiti, when it comes to what we've seen in the last 3 weeks in Haiti, we've seen a lot of generosity and solidarity by many, if not most, Canadians towards Haiti in this time of obvious need. So the Canadian government, to the extent to which it has acted humanely towards Haitians over the past 3 weeks, and there's a certain element of that. I think there's a certain element of help that has been brought, even by Canadian troops, even though it shouldn't be soldiers there, it should be doctors and whatever. The soldiers even have brought a certain amount of help to Haitians in this horrible time. But the extent to which the Canadian government has acted humanely is because of that generosity and solidarity and that interest of the Canadian population towards Haitians right now. And what's unfortunately all too likely to happen over the next weeks, months, years, is that as the media moves away from focusing on Haiti, and as the majority of us focus less and less on what's going on in the country, the most pro-empire and pro-corporate interests elements of Canadian foreign policy are going to come out because they're going to be allowed to. They're going to be without a mobilized Canadian public demanding otherwise. So I think it's imperative over the next weeks and months that we continue to pay attention to what Canada is doing in Haiti, and we make sure that this reconstruction process that's about or starting to take place is designed in a way to serve the interests of the majority of Haitians, impoverished Haitians, not the interests of Canadian companies like SNC-Lavalin and Guild and Activewear. Thank you very much.